more than 25 million albums sold over their 42-year career, James are amongst the most successful alternative rock bands of their era, with hits like Laid, Sit Down and Getting Away With It, earning them cult status and an incredibly loyal fan following. James continued to appeal to audiences, releasing their 18th studio album, Yummy, in April and performing to thousands at Glastonbury. James will be performing at the National Museum of Ireland, Collins Barracks, as part of the Wider Than Picture Concert Dates on Monday the 26th of August, with support from the Zootons. Jim Glynnie, the band's founder and bass player, joins me now from his home in the picturesque Scottish Highlands. Before we begin, let's play the iconic track that has festival goers bopping at Glastonbury and ultimately catapulted the band to international acclaim. That's Sit Down by James from 1982, and I'm delighted to be talking to Jim Glynnie. Jim, for those who haven't seen James live, is it true that audiences sit down during Sit Down?
Well, they certainly used to. They do on occasion. It has been known. It was just one of those weird things that I think it started in clubs at the time, back when The Sun came out, and people just obviously probably sitting in pools of beer, to be honest with you, but
can you imagine? Yeah,
it doesn't sound great, does it? And they'd sit on the ground and sing the song in clubs, and then it kind of would happen at gigs and the odd festival again. But it does very occasionally, but it does still happen.
Now, the band James is called after you. Tell us how that came about. Tell us how the band started off in Manchester back in 82.
Sure. Well, obviously, back in the day, going back a while now, nobody who knew who we were. So it kind of didn't really seem ridiculously important what the band was called. We kept changing the name all the time, and it didn't seem to really matter. And we liked the idea of the band having a person's name, almost as if the band was a person, you know, like different characters, personalities, almost the embodiment in a way. And we were thinking of using a name of somebody in the band. We didn't want to use Tim because he was the singer, so it kind of seemed like it was all about him then, really. Our drummer was called Gavin. For some reason, we thought that sounded heavy metal. I don't know why, but Gavin sounded heavy metal, but we did. So he was crossed off the list, which left me and the guitar player, Paul. So it's either James or Paul. Now, no one's ever called me James. Like, I was Jimmy when I was younger, and now I'm Jim. So it doesn't matter, really. It doesn't kind of mean anything to me. James anymore has always symbolised the band. So I'm Jim from James. And it's funny because my name officially is James. On my passport, it's James. But, like, just no one's ever called me that. And that was it. The band, the name stuck.
And it's a strong name, isn't it? With a, you know, tradition and everything. It's a great name.
I think so, yeah. No, I like the idea. It doesn't kind of give you any idea of what or who we are. We don't like that at the time. You know, it doesn't sound like a band. And even if you knew it was a band, you wouldn't know what kind of music it was. And we kind of like that.
So at the beginning, Jim, there was you, there was Paul Gilbertson, and there was Gavin, aforementioned Gavin Whelan. Yeah. And Tim was a little later on the scene. How did he come to find you and start playing with you?
We kind of bumped into him in the Students' Union bar in Manchester. He was at Manchester University. And we used to go in the Students' Union bar just to listen because music was great. And we used to have to get signed in because we weren't students. You had to kind of stand outside. And as people were going and asked them, would they kindly sign you in as a guest? So we did that and we got in there. And probably shouldn't admit to this really, but we were stealing drinks. We had no money. So we were nicking people's drinks. So when somebody put a drink down, don't do this at home, kids. When somebody put a drink down, we'd go and pick it up and wander off with it. And we did it to Tim. And kind of Tim kind of stood up to whoever was doing it. And there was three of us. So he kind of sensibly kind of stepped down. And we just ended up having a conversation with him. And Paul, guitar player Paul Gilbertson, as you mentioned before, he was a mad, mad keen dancer, and he'd seen Tim dancing. And he said to Tim, do you want to come along to one of our rehearsals and basically, you know, dance on stage when we play a show? And Tim agreed, and Paul wrote his telephone number. Actually, I think he wrote the address of where we were going to be rehearsing the next day, which is a scout hut in Withington in Manchester, on the back of Tim's hand. Tim woke up the next morning, looked at the back of his hand with the name of the scout hut on, and he turned up to the rehearsal. And that was it. It was just a bizarre chance meeting in a bar that could have so easily not happened, and all our lives would be very, very different if so.
I was listening to Tim recently talking about the way you create songs as a band, and he says that you don't go in with any ideas and you just start jamming and playing, and out of that evolves the songs. I mean, there might be some crafting afterwards when he goes off maybe to write some lyrics, but the ideas happen between you all in the rehearsal space.
Yes, we have a bizarre way of writing, which, as you said, all the four writers, which myself, Tim, Saul, who plays guitar and violin in the band, and Mark, the keyboard player, we get together in a rehearsal space somewhere and we switch on a drum machine, and the drum machine just keeps going. That's the great thing about a drum machine. It doesn't stop because it's tired, or it doesn't stop to fiddle with its phone. It just keeps banging away, and it's not shy or embarrassed. It just keeps going. And as soon as we start playing, we record it, record everything on multi-track so we can work on it later. And we just play, we listen and we play, and the things tend to be a little bit tentative and uncertain at first, but then something appears, something forms. And those things end up being our songs. Those initial jams can be anything from 10 minutes up to well over an hour. And what we do then, as you said earlier, is we take them then into kind of our home studios and work on the big chunks of music and start to kind of cut them up and chop them around and turn them into demos, I suppose. And that's the beginning of the songwriting process. But all our songs, yeah, we just get in the room and nobody takes anything in. No, we don't have any chord progressions worked out in advance or any parts or anything. It's just, and we don't speak very much. You know, we don't talk a lot while we're doing it. It's just, we just play. And it's obviously our stepping stones to ending up with songs, which is all this is based on, but it's also really, really, really good fun. And a lot of the time, the jams, even if they don't go anywhere or don't end up being songs, they're just kind of really interesting and odd in their own right. Just a wonderful thing to do, even if it doesn't end up being a stepping stone for a song. The actual process is really, really good fun and really interesting.
And then when you wrote Sit Down or jammed and it was evolving, did you look at each other and go, that's a good one?
Yeah. I mean, that one fell into place ridiculously easy. We just all, it only lasted about, the initial jam was about 20 minutes and we had all the bits, basically. Just like, it was almost like it just fell almost fully formed for us. It was just ridiculous. That very, very rarely happens. It's usually a lot harder work than that. And we just cracked up laughing when we stopped. We just kind of knew we'd got something that was catchy and immediate and very, very, very strong. That was a kind of an exception. I say that doesn't normally, don't fall from the tree like that. You know, it's usually a lot more process involved in it. We're very good at working out what the seeds of good songs are. We're really good at that. We've got very, very good at that now. But it usually takes quite a lot of process after that, chopping things around and moving things about to kind of finalise where a song wants to be. But Sit Down was just virtually there straight away. It was just like, bang, there you go.
Looking back on those earlier days now, do you think that you, I don't know, in some ways self-sabotaged yourselves because you were quite principled, weren't you, about what you'd release in the States, for example, or also being, you know, always going for art over commercial gain?
Yeah, we were awkward and difficult, and we were awkward and difficult to work with. There's no two ways about it. We were very wary of the industry as well at the beginning. The big bad record companies, you know, we were kind of didn't trust anybody, rightly or wrongly so, but we didn't trust anybody. And we were very defensive. We were protective of the music and protective of just everything, really. And I think that probably, I mean, I'm reluctant to say it held us back because, you know, our path has become our path and our journey, and we've just celebrated 40 years. So something's gone right, you know. But I think, yeah, we ended up not kind of jumping on success really quickly and early. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, you're people at the end of the day, and you have human frailties of personalities and characters and egos and all the rest of it. And I think you need a little bit of solidity between yourselves and individually as individuals to tackle that kind of world without going into meltdown. So I don't think waiting did us any harm.
Yes, and those good artistic choices that you made and the songs that you created together in those kind of heated artistic settings, you know, attracted people like Brian Eno, who could choose anyone he wanted to work with, and he chose to work with James.
Yes, we'd been trying to work with Brian for a while. We kept sending him requests every time we had an album out, send him a demo and ask him to produce a record. I've never heard anything. And then it was the demos for the album Laid. Tim sent them to Brian and wrote a little personal note in it. And unbeknownst to us, Brian went on holiday and took the demo with him and absolutely fell in love with it, completely fell in love with it, with the songs. And when he came back off holiday, he rang Tim up and said, "Hello, Tim, this is Brian Eno." And Tim thought it was somebody winding him up. And it was as simple as that. It wasn't like, "Oh, you know, your people talk to my people." It was Brian just rang Tim up. And we did, ended up doing five albums with Eno in the end. Wonderful, and, absolutely wonderful.
And what did you bring to Eno then? Would you have done those early jam sessions where you come up with the songs, or was he involved in those as well?
Well, funnily you should say that, because well, the album proper, if you like, that became Laid, that was demos that had been worked up from jams that we'd done on our own and then kind of gone into rehearsal room and worked through with the band to quite a developed stage. Brian still came in and messed around with things and chopped things up and added sort of, you know, the Eno touch, mm-hmm. if you like, to those. But at the same time, we were working on another album called Wawa, which was the initial, well, some of the jams that had either not made it onto to Laid, or some of the jams we were doing around the same time in the studio with Brian. So Brian would get us to do little jams in the studio after dinner, and then we'd work on those songs as an alternative album, and that album became Wawa. So Laid was basically two albums, really. It was Laid and Wawa that were done at the same time. One, which was the big proper songs, if you like, which was Laid, you know, the Say Something Sometimes, blah, 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 all those big mm-hmm. tunes on there. But then there was this kind of counter album, which was Wawa, which is just experimental little bits of sounds. I mean, I think there's like 20-odd pieces of music on that record. Some of them just fade in and fade out after 30 seconds, just really, really odd. But Brian loved those, and he loved those, how they existed, rather than being necessarily being stepping stones to songs. Brian saw a value in them in their own right, those kind of little embryonic pieces. And he got his assistant, Marcus Strauss, who's now a world-famous producer in his own right. Marcus back then was just an engineer, and he got Marcus in the second studio to work on these little tiny seeds of jams and just smash them up. You know, really, really kind of be irreverent to them. And we ended up with, as I said, two albums from the session, Laid them to kind of the big proper album, if you like, and then Wawa, this kind of very experimental, kind of strange kind of piece of work, which is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Jim, on the band side of things, you've written a lot about, and you've talked a lot about, the importance of looking after your mental health, especially in the industry you're in. I think you've said that most people don't go into work where there's tables and tables of booze everywhere. And the band has gone through, I think, what you've called a bad marriage at times, you know, that things can get tough on the road and tough when you're living in each other's pockets and all those terrible temptations.
I mean, that's all very, very true. I mean, you know, there's lots of professions where it's difficult to keep, you know, work-life balance, and there's lots of also professions other than the music business where people go away working away from home, but that doesn't make it any easier. You know, you have to put time and effort into relationships. You know, your home life will suffer if you don't do that. We do go away a lot. Yeah, I mean, as you're saying, you know, when I turn up to work, it's different now because James doesn't have an alcohol rider. The rider's basically the booze that's waiting for you at each gig when you turn up. And when you go to sound check at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there's a table of free alcohol there that you're expected to drink that day, because another one will be turning up at the next gig the next day. And it's just really destructive. It's just it's not good. Mm-hmm. And also just almost like the industry expects you at some point to have a car crash moment where you've got problems with an addiction. It just seems like that's kind of, oh, well, that will happen at some point, you know. And it feels like you're back in the 1970s or something. It just feels so outdated and old-fashioned. And I think we just need to move away from that. You don't need that to make music. You really, really, really don't. And you put a bunch of, you know, naive young lads, really, into a world where you're surrounded by that with, you know, a huge shot of kind of success and boosting your ego and completely losing the plot and, you know, your feet aren't on the ground anymore. And guess what? You end up with problems. You end up with personal problems. You end up with problems in the relationships in the band. And as you were saying, you know, that can really, really easily happen and it can mess everything up. This is an incredible job I've got, but it's dead easy to mess it up. If you lose those relationships and you can't work together with the people, then the whole thing just goes. And that's just ridiculous, really. It's really, really silly. And some of it's personal discipline. Some of it's about being an adult in a situation that's sometimes quite difficult. But some of it also is that culture in the music business of booze and excess and, you know, all the rest of it that comes with being in a band, the expected lifestyle in a way, which is just, I say, it just seems so outdated now. We really need to leave that behind.
Well, Jim, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you for all your time. And we're thrilled to have James at Collins Barracks on Monday, the 26th of August. We're going to finish with Sometimes. That's Sometimes from James, and our thanks to Jim Glennie, the original James. You can see James live at the National Museum of Ireland, Collins Barracks, Dublin, on Monday the 26th of August with support from the Zootons. This is part of the Wider Than Pictures concert dates. More information is available from ticketmaster.ie and singularartist.ie. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. What do films like The Matrix, The Blair Witch Project, Magnolia, Fight Club and The Sixth Sense have in common? Well, they're all classics, yes, and they are all films that spawned 1,000 imitators. But did you know that they were all released in the year 1999? That is in no way an exhaustive list, either of the extraordinary films that came out of Hollywood that year. In 1999, something remarkable happened in American cinema, and though it might not have been obvious at the time, it certainly is now. With me now to dig out their favourites from 1999 and try and figure out what allowed these perfect storm of a year to happen and these years to and these films to appear are Peter Murphy and Jimma Cray. You're very welcome, Peter and Jimma. In getting your choices from 1999, Peter, did you explore, and I know you've talked to Jimma while you were both making these choices, did you explore the why of it?
We did, and it came down to one thing that we tended to agree on. Money. Loads of money. Money, money, money.
And why was there just... Hollywood was awash with money the years leading up to 1999?
From the late 70s... Well, from the blockbuster era, the mid-80s, or probably Jaws and Star Wars on, all the way up to the millennium, Hollywood cinema particularly was raking it in, and with the introduction of video and then DVD, there were residuals. Every movie, even if a movie was a turkey in the cinema, like Blade Runner, it went on to have an afterlife. So the studios could effectively take risks and subsidize independent directors. So the 90s was just this gorgeous treasure fest of movies like from people like Gus Van Sant or Dorothy Allison or Jane Campion that were actually blockbusters.
Okay, so there's lots of money, but it isn't always so lucky, is it, Gemma, that then you have the creative force to make the films?
Yeah, so if you think of it, at that time, games wasn't quite the competition that it was in terms of entertainment share, where now it's actually making a lot more money. Or prestige TV wasn't taking the writers and actors away to, you know, to work on their kind of gritty shows either. It was a very much so, film was the top of the hierarchy in terms of entertainment, that people still went to the cinema.
And did it happen that there was just great talent around at that time?
I think there was probably more resources to support them. If you think as well, there's music videos were such a huge force. Like Sofia Coppola, she cut her teeth. There's so many more people can, you know, kind of experiment with form and textures and visual interesting kind of layers, in a way that you maybe, if you're struck to doing like broadcast TV and a very kind of regimented three act structure, you can't mess around with it as much.
And your average MTV video budget was about the same as a feature movie these days. So you'd like David Fincher and Mark Romanek and even documentary makers like Penelope Spheeris and Mary Harron went on to make American Psycho. So like a real finishing school.
We're speaking about 1999 and the phenomenal year it was for films that came out of Hollywood. And as Peter and Gemma said there, a lot had to do with the money that was coming into the coffers of Hollywood producers. So Peter Murphy and Gemma Cray have made their choices. Peter, let's go to you first of all. You've chosen Magnolia. This is Paul Thomas Anderson's film, which has a lot, really, a kind of a nod to Robert Altman in some ways.
It's got that Altman-like blueprint, which is a cross-section of a large cast across a particular society, a la Nashville or Shortcuts or The Player. It's kind of a stealth musical, is the weird thing about Magnolia. He wrote it around a bunch of songs from a May Man's record, Bachelor Number 2. The best known tunes of which would be maybe Save Me or Wise Up. So they soundtrack crucial scenes. All the characters are going through some sort of emotional bottleneck, and at a crucial point in the movie, they all sort of have a simultaneous nervous breakdown. So there's a child quiz prodigy who needs to go to the bathroom before a crucial game, and the overzealous floor manager won't let him. So he's in agony throughout. And there's Julianne Moore, a woman who married for money but has since fallen in love, and she's on the nerve of a virtuous breakdown. Jason Robards is dying of cancer. There's Frank Mackey, a sort of proto-manosphere, misogynistic, motivational speaker who comes face to face with his father issues. And there's an amazing performance by Philip Seymour Hoffman as the care nurse. And in an audacious move, they all end up lip-syncing to Wise Up about three quarters of the way through the movie. And there's also a sort of unexplained biblical torrent of frogs. And if this all sounds bizarre, it's actually a really beautifully told.
Yes, and all those scenes are so embedded in the mind after seeing it. And there was also an extraordinary casting of Tom Cruise,
who, it's kind of scary looking at this and a couple of our other choices as into how much they predict noxious subcultures that would emerge over the next 20 years. So you can, if you dare, go on to the manosphere on Reddit or YouTube or whatever and meet these kind of hyper macho Andrew Tate type cornball motivational speakers. But he was based on a pickup artist who actually appeared in Neil Strauss's book, The Game.
Okay, well, let's listen to something of Tom Cruise playing Frank T.J. Mackey in Magnolia.
I am the one who's in charge. I am the one who says yes. No. Now. Here. It's universal, man. It is evolutional. It is anthropological. It is biological. Oh. It is Enema. We are.
Tom Cruise there in Magnolia. Gemma, your first choice is American Beauty. It was directed by Sam Mendes. And Sam Mendes, up to that, was really known as a theatre director.
Yes, and he does such a beautiful job finding a really kind of rich visual language for this film. I mean, he works from a script for Alan Ball, and apparently when he came to direct it, cut 27 minutes from I thought it was a very interesting choice as a director to cut that. There was originally scenes at the beginning and end that were a court scene of the young kids that find love being framed for Kevin Spacey's murder. And actually it starts much more poetically, and again, everything is told through subtext. So
at the centre of it is Kevin Spacey as Lester Burnham. Tell us about him and his problematic relationship with his wife.
Yeah, so Lester is henpecked, and he's berated and belittled by a vacuous wife who's a real estate agent. Of course she is. Carolyn, who's played by Annette Bening, and she has like that real kind of classic 90s Karen hair. He's also detached from his daughter Jane, who's very cold and withholding from him. And he sees himself as, he's very cranky and quipping consistently. And all of a sudden, when he meets the very, very beautiful Angela Hayes, played by Mina Savary, he's awakened.
She's a friend of his daughter and a
16-year-old child who's, you know, like coming and hanging out in his daughter's bedroom, like eating sweets and stuff like that. And they're both on the cheerleading team together. So he creates a kind of fantasy world around this very young character. He finds himself awakened, like he's a new man. He's suddenly in this very kind of banal job that he has no connection to, and you know, he just quits it, and he orchestrates a nice kind of like pay bump out of that. He starts working in a burger shop, much to the disgust of his wife Carolyn, who's really into like expensive couches and the big house. So in many ways it is a comment on consumerism, about his rejection of that, but I think fundamentally what it is it's about him asserting his dominance as a man. And just as Tom Cruise quipped in that last clip, like this is a really common thread in so many films. So he starts off this journey henpecked. I mean, it is a beautifully crafted script in terms of character development, in terms of the inevitable pull and push of the arcs of how everything intertwines together. But I mean, at the core of something is really sort of toxic and problematic that you don't realise it.
Let's get a bit of the toxicity in American Beauty here. Annette Bening and Kevin Spacey experience marital difficulties.
What?
Whose car is that out front?
Mine. 1970 Pontiac Firebird, the car I've always wanted, and now I have it. I rule.
Uh-huh, where's the Camry?
I traded it in.
Shouldn't you have consulted me first?
Let me think. No, you never drove it. Have you done something different? You look great.
Where's Jane?
Jane not home. We have the whole house to ourselves. Christ, Carolyn. When did you become so joyless?
Joyless?
It's a little bit like he's been listening to the Tom Cruise character in Magnolia, and he has changed his life around and become a real man.
Which will feed right directly into my next choice.
Go ahead, Fight Club. Let's get out there and punch someone you never met before.
I must say, there's a couple of choices in this list that have, you know, honourable men in them, but we'll come to that. Fight Club is basically, it's based on a Chuck Palahniuk novel from 1996, which Fascinating. It was based on inspired by Susan Faludi's book, Stiffed, The Betrayal of the Modern Man. Susan Faludi was a feminist writer who wrote a book called Backlash, The Undeclared War Against Women in the early 90s, and then did some research and looked into the betrayal of the working class, I should stress, the working class male in America post-war. So, Polonik read this. It's basically a delayed coming-of-age tale starring a whiny, spoiled desk monkey played by Ed Norton, who has been putting off adulthood until his 30s, has a sort of breakdown, encounters a character called, he can't sleep, he's an insomniac. He encounters two characters, Marla Singer, played by Helena Bonham Carter, has a wonderfully mordant sort of goth Dorothy Parker, and Tyler Durden, who is Brad Pitt with less than 10% body fat and abs you could abseil on. And Tyler Durden is his sort of alter ego. It's almost like a closeted love story. And one night, Tyler Durden says, "Hit me," and Ed Norton hits him, and they get into a fight. And the rest of the movie is almost like a inversion of Mike Tyson's quip that nobody has a plan until they get punched in the face. It's about, I guess, it's a sort of fable about how in a gentrified, desk-bound existence, the male doesn't have any coming-of-age rituals anymore. And but it all goes horribly toxic. It should be made clear that for all its whininess and all, Gemma had rewatched this before I had, and I rewatched it over the weekend, and I was astonished at how kind of snide some of the first act was, particularly with regard to cancer survivors and support groups. But I will say the last half of the movie is a brilliant satire on I hate the phrase toxic masculinity, but let's just say toxic behaviour exhibited by males gone horribly anarchically wrong.
Yes, and there's a lot of it in the choices you're making here from 1999. So there was something afoot which has manifested itself maybe since, you know, 2016.
It absolutely predicted the incel, the Reddit group, a certain sort of far-right libertarian, deeply embarrassing 14-year-old boy's idea of masculinity.
And I think it was definitely, there's so much anti-consumerism. I think it's a really privileged time in American history. It's just before 9/11 when the dialogue shifted to be more about physical and existential threat. It's just before the boom. So people were wealthy and bored for the most part. And I think you can really feel that through it because they've nothing else to give out about except for that they don't really like their jobs that much.
So you have chosen another film where two men bash each other apart. This is the wonderful The Talented Mr. Ripley by Anthony Minghella.
Yes, so this is a long list of interpretations of The Talented Mr. Ripley, and one might also say that Saltburn is a variant on that because there's so many comparisons to that. But this version of it, I think, is particularly interesting because it leans into the queerness in a very kind of subtextual way that and has a chemistry between the leads. So it's interesting in that. So this one is, it starts off with Tom Ripley is a bit of a grifter. He's hired by this very wealthy shipbuilding mongol who is who really wants to get his son back. And he's over living an amazing life in Italy, having an incredible time with his fiancée, sunning himself, having an incredible time with his partner, who's played by Marge, who's played and who's very loyal, played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
And obviously Matt Damon is playing Ripley, and Jude Law is playing Dickie Greenleaf.
Yeah, and again, like, we have Philip Seymour Hoffman is in this as well. They have Cate Blanchett. Like, again, these are actors kind of like coming into their own as a career, that we're catching them at that moment. And there's such chemistry, because it's all about what isn't spoken.
Let's move on to another one of yours. This is The Matrix.
Yeah. At long last, we have an equivalence in terms of character strength here. All credit to the Wachowskis. This was quite inclusive and groundbreaking in terms of race, gender, and every other box you want to tick. Very stylish, maybe the ultimate cyberpunk movie. So what's amazing about The Matrix is it's kind of a philosophical as much as an action flick. It pulls on bits of Philip K. Dick, bits of the Gnostics, bits of the postmodernists. Basically, I mean, we've all seen it, so I'm not going to give anything away, but Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, comes awake into a world of conformity and security, gets pulled out of it by Morpheus, who offers him the red pill or the blue pill, and realizes that he's been living in a gigantic simulacrum of existence run by a parasitic AI overlord network. And he joins forces. He's a sort of Buddha, Christ-like, heroic figure. The Matrix
in
is
the coolest outfits.
In the coolest outfits. So we're talking about leather trench coats and wraparound shades and leather cat suits and a lot of incredible bullet time ballet fight sequences. And the film is frequently taught, along with Silence of the Lambs and Star Wars, as a beat for beat reading of Joseph Campbell's monomyth or The Hero's Journey, How to Write a Screenplay.
Oh, okay. I was going to just jump in a time machine, go back to 1999, but now maybe I'll just read that and make my own.
I would say it's quite prophetic in terms of just certain lines become, you know, part of the common language. I got red-pilled, meaning, you know, you came to an awakening of how things really are, which also got co-opted by the incel community, if you want to call them a bunch of people sitting over a computer by themselves, a community.
Okay, well, we're all 1999, and thank you very much, Jim McRae and Peter Murphy, for going back on the films of 1999. Truly a great year. Kerry footballing legend Pat Spillane is the inspiration for Ham Sandwiches and Discipline, a new show from Nora Nianlun Fay and her company Naff Dance. It's a comedic contemporary duet about the GAA, and it's performed by Nora and Ben Sullivan at this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. Nora Nianlun Fay is with me in studio. Nora, you're so welcome.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Now, bring us into the moment of inspiration regarding Pat Spillane.
It was a really magical moment in a way. It was almost kind of 2-3 years ago now at this point. I was just watching the Sunday game with my family, and I just saw Pat Spillane's hands and the way they kind of took over his whole being and his body were just...
Now, this is when he's doing the analysis.
Yeah, of course, yes. And it was just so theatrical. I immediately saw there's something in that. And I said, that's the first thing I'll do after I graduated college last year, that I'll do this piece. Whatever that is in the GA, there's a piece there. And I think then it was kind of from that starting point, seeing actually what does it mean then to bring dance and the GA together.
Right. So what was he doing? Like, he was using his hands to make points?
Yeah, it was so detailed and it was almost like pouring out of him. It was this whole kind of body language. It felt like Pina Bausch or Martha Graham was in the room with him then. It was hypnotic to watch. So I began to think, how can you fuse these two things together? So we started very basically by trying different kind of movements and things I do in sport, like kicking or passing, even putting the jerseys on. And then from there, we're thinking, actually, what is this piece doing? What is it in a way? And it was kind of, we took ownership being like, oh no, this is a Naff Dance piece in a way. So what does that mean? So with Naff Dance, it's kind of comedic, slapstick comedy, very disco and camp is a language we work with. So when we allowed ourselves to kind of pour the two things together, we're like, oh, this is the piece now. This, it's beginning to make sense now.
And then when you were building the piece, you found other inspiration besides Pat's Balan.
Yes, yeah, there are kind of many disco and kind of fabulous references we use, but I think there was Paul Mescal as well. I think it is a real icon in a way with his kind of short GA shorts that have become such a fashion kind of muse in a way now. And he did an interview for a Chicken Shop Date as well, was the kind of feature in that. So it's Paul Mescal, GA, disco cam. There's something in it there for everyone in a way.
Okay, so we're going to listen to a clip now. So what is the clip we're going to listen to?
Yes, yeah, it was kind of 2 weeks before he premiered at Seen and Heard Festival last February. I heard this clip from Paul Mescal in an interview for a show called Chicken Shop Date, and he's talking about the GA and almost what it means, and it was kind of sarcastic as well, but it was also, I love the way he described it, and kind of mixing that with disco music is what the piece is in a way.
So what's Gaelic football?
It's where lots of sad, sexy men run around in tiny shorts.
Oh my god.
Gaelic football is the national sport in Ireland.
So the national sport
is an amateur sport.
Ireland is an amateur sport.
It's kind of amazing because then people don't do, like, it's not corrupted by money.
Mm-hmm. You know, like everything else. Well.
Like soccer.
So that's a clip from Nora Nianlun's Fay's new show, which is called Ham Sandwiches and Discipline. And that was Amelia de Muldenberg. And
yes,
she is the host of that YouTube show that
you
sampled for your show,
yes.
Really. Yeah. And you are a great fan of Gaelic games, football.
Oh, definitely.
In particular.
Yeah. I've never played myself, so I feel like I've always had to kind of prove that in a way that I do actually know what it is and I'm talking about. So I think it was so important then for us when we were first researching it to kind of, we were in Illan Arts Centre in Skibbereen.
So who are we? You go to college in the Netherlands.
Yes, in Fontys University there.
Yeah, and that's where you were a dancer here in Ireland, but that's where you've developed your craft.
Yes, I think it's really there that I understood the kind of the movement language and the work I want to make. And I think coming back from there and coming back to Ireland, I was inevitable I was going to make a piece about Irishness. I didn't necessarily know it at the time, but I think the more time I've been back here over the last few months, I realised, oh, that's what the piece is. And that's why I had this urge to make it in a way. So I think we've really used the structure of the GA to see what it's like growing up in Ireland from the kind of teenage discos in the local GA clubs or the Paul Mescals or even just the kind of school matches that are always coinciding with your life in a way. So it's whether you play or not, it's always a kind of pinnacle in growing up. So how does that create an Irish identity and what does that do to us?
And now you did workshop this within the GAA as well,
yes,
within girls' Gaelic football,
yes,
is it, or
exactly,
ladies' Gaelic football?
Yeah, it was a lovely club in Skibbereen down in Cork, a Donovan Rossa GA club, and they were great. It was we spoke to them and we just chatted, like, what do you want to see in a kind of theatre show with GA? What does it mean to you and how do you imagine these two worlds kind of coinciding? Because I think as we were going into it, we didn't know in a way, but I think it's now so clear to us kind of what the piece is in a way, and it's just an open letter to that kind of ideas of Irishness in a way, and I think it's anyone can see how they resonate then with that.
So we know you've talked about the hands of,
yes,
of Pat's Balan, but then within that experience in the GAA club in Skibbereen, was movement inspired by the movement of the ladies playing football?
Yeah, I think so. And it really allowed us to kind of see all the different characters that are involved in GA in a way. So we have the kind of mammies on the sideline. We have these batty umpires and these kind of manic bonnestores as well all throughout. So we get to see each character then through it. And then so myself and Ben Sullivan, we take on all these different characters in a way. So we really go on a kind of a wild journey. We have such fun with it. We've got amazing costumes. Like the bonnestore ones are kind of inspired by Drag Race costumes and Megamind and all. So it's all these kind of funny references that aren't necessarily associated with the world of the GA or that kind of language and tone, that we get to pull these two kind of contrasting things together and create just such fun and joy on stage then.
Yes, because I remember years ago, Dunbelievables, John Kenny and Pat Short did a theatre show, you know, with the banished door shouting and roaring, trying to motivate the team. So it's interesting now that it's a contemporary dance group are looking at the same material and seeing how theatrical it can be.
Yeah, because I think definitely with dance, it's often such an abstract thing to people as well as to kind of what it is in contemporary dance in particular then. So I think using that MGA to kind of access that, it's allowed loads of different people into the theatre. Like, for example, when we did it in Seen and Heard and brought it to Paris then, and then Galway Theatre Festival. So it's kind of really built with it. It was amazing seeing kind of French accents laughing about jokes, mammy's getting their steps in and everything. And these inherently kind of Irish things, but that translated and that people understood the world we were tapping into as well.
And now, did you discuss this in your groups in Holland, and what did they make of it?
Yeah. I remember so clearly kind of the first week there almost 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago now, when I started, the All-Ireland football final was on, and I brought everyone, all these internationals, to the kind of Irish bar there, and they were almost terrified of what was happening on screen. They had no idea the kind of ferocity and the competitiveness of it. And then me and the other Irish, we became absolutely feral watching it. It kind of just took over us, and they hadn't seen us ever like that before. So I think they were so hypnotized by the passion of it and what it means then, why we're so invested in something that's an amateur sport as well, and to kind of what that connection we have with the country it is.
All right. So you said how important music is, and it's a very disco vibe in it. And I suppose the mammy of all the discos is Donna Summers. And this is, I feel, love. There, that's Donna Summer, one part of the music for Ham Sandwiches and Discipline that will be at the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray. All ready for it, Nora?
Oh, dying for it. We could have a great run, The Mermaid and the Fringe, as well. I'm absolutely excited for it now.
Well, the show is going to be on at the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray from September the 6th and at the Lehr Academy in Dublin from the 8th to the 11th of September as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. Further details at fringefest.com. That's it for tonight's show. The show was researched by Paula Shields and Barbara Rose Sanwo. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound. Tonight's show was produced by Nessa McLaughlin, and John Creedon is next.